to our origin of We the People. Tackling current issues, both political and legal, with common sense. As We the People, we must bring common sense back to make our lives better. Only on Now Media TV.
Good evening, and welcome to We the People. Tonight, we begin with what is being described across headlines as a ceasefire between the United States and America. But I want to start by asking you a very simple question. What does a ceasefire actually mean if the fighting hasn't really stopped? Because that's where we are right now. We're being told that there's a pause in hostilities, that diplomacy is working, that tensions are easing. And yet, when you look just beneath the surface, what you see is something very different. You see confusion, you see contradiction, and most importantly, you see a situation that is still incredibly volatile. Just days ago, the United States and Iran agreed to what is being called a two-week ceasefire, a temporary pause intended to stop the escalation and create space for negotiation. The agreement reportedly brokered with help from international intermediaries was supposed to do three things: pause the fighting, stabilize the region, and open the door to longer-term diplomacy, and also, I'll put in a fourth, open the Strait of Hormuz. Now, on paper, that sounds like progress. It sounds like a win. And depending on who you listen to, that is exactly how it's being framed. But here's where the story becomes more complicated. And frankly, more concerning. Because almost immediately after this agreement was announced, it became clear that there is no shared understanding of what the ceasefire actually includes. So let me reiterate. There is no clear, unified agreement on the terms. The United States has one interpretation, Iran has another, and Israel, arguably one of the most critical players in this entire situation, is operating on its own independent track. So what does that mean in real terms? It means that what is being presented as a coordinated pause is, in reality, a loosely aligned, highly fragile arrangement where each party is moving based on its own priorities. And that's not a ceasefire. That's a pause with conditions, which this really always has been. It's just a pause. No one fully agrees on anything. Just take a pause. Now, one of the biggest points of contention, and one that could ultimately determine whether this holds or collapses, is the question of Lebanon. Because here's where things get very serious. The United States has indicated that Lebanon is not part of this ceasefire agreement. Iran, on the other hand, has suggested that it is included, at least in terms of broader regional de-escalation, and demanding that Israel cease all actions within Lebanon. And Israel? Israel has continued active military operations inside Lebanon to root out Hezbollah, a terrorist organization that has been in control of Lebanon, that is funded, directed, and at the behest of Iran. And Israel's military operations include airstrikes that have resulted in significant casualties, but also Iran is still shooting fire missiles at Tel Aviv. So let's be clear about what that means. We are currently in a situation where a ceasefire has been declared, and yet military strikes are still occurring, and civilians are still being affected, and tensions are still escalating in key areas. So again, I ask you, what exactly has been paused? Because it's certainly not the risk. It's not the instability. And it's certainly not the broader strategic conflict that is playing out behind the scenes. Now, to understand why this is important, or why this matters so much, is you have to look beyond the immediate headlines and focus on what is actually at stake here. And we are talking about geopolitical points, the Strait of Hormuz, which is one of the most critical geographic points in the world, especially for many countries that are dependent for oil to go through that strait. So if you're watching global news for any length of time, you've probably heard that name before. But let's take a moment to really understand its significance. The Strait of Hormuz is a narrow passageway that connects the Persian Gulf to the rest of the world's oceans. And through this narrow passage flows roughly 20% of the world's oil supply. Not 5%, not 10%, 20%. That means what happens in this one location, this one little narrow strip, has the power to influence energy markets, economies, and political stability across the entire globe. And right now, that passageway is not functioning normally. It has been blocked by Iran. Shipping was all but stopped. Tankers have been delayed. And there are ongoing concerns about safety, including reports suggesting that naval threats, potentially even sea mines, have not been fully cleared. And perhaps most importantly, Iran has signaled that it retains significant control over what happens in that space, even demanding tolls, if you will, on the ships that are going through. So while there may be a ceasefire on paper, there is still enormous leverage being exercised in reality by both Iran and the United States, because control of energy is power. And right now that power is very much in play. Because remember, President Trump has promised that he will go after every infrastructure within Iran. He even said he would bomb it into non-existence if necessary, which obviously, as we all know, he is extremely bombastic. But there is a bigger play, because the Strait of Hormuz is what Saudi Arabia depends on to get oil out, although they're now finding other routes around. It is one of the key components for oil supplies for Europe. So let's look at the broader picture. What we are witnessing is not simply a military conflict. It is not a diplomatic negotiation. This is a strategic positioning exercise between major players who are all trying to maintain or expand their influence. And let's face it, when it comes to Iran and it comes to the United States and Israel, there is very much distinct lines drawn in the sand. Iran is demonstrating that it cannot be easily sidelined, regardless of how many of regime leaders they go through, because they have been unalived through this military combat. The United States is signaling that it remains willingly and able to respond with force if necessary. And that is a real threat. And Israel is making it clear that it will act independently to protect its interests, regardless of broader agreements, because Israel's first duty is to protecting its citizens from perceived threats. And Hezbollah is not just a perceived threat, it is an actual threat. So when you hear that word, ceasefire, I want you to think about it differently, because it's not a resolution, it's not a closure, and it's not even necessarily a de-escalation. It's just a pause, just like what we saw with the Gaza Strip. It is just a pause to allow each side to reassess and allow the Palestinians, which are the key negotiators, middleman, neutral party, to try to come up with some type of agreement. It is a reposition. And then we'll see what happens next. And that brings us to the political dimension of this story, because President Trump has been very clear in his messaging. He has framed the ceasefire as an opportunity, but not as an endpoint. He has warned that if Iran fails to comply with expectations, the U.S. is prepared to escalate again. And not just escalate, but potentially respond with even greater force than we have already seen. So from a leadership perspective, what we are seeing is a balancing act. On one hand, presenting diplomacy. On the other, maintaining pressure. And that is a very delicate line to walk, especially when you take into consideration that the people of Iran, the ones that want to be free of this oppressive autocratic regime, because there cannot be a risk of miscalculation. If one side believes the agreement includes certain conditions and the other side does not, if one side believes certain regions are protected and the other side continues operations, This is how conflicts reignite. This is how escalation happens. And not always intentionally, but often as a result of conflicting assumptions. And that is exactly why the analysts and experts are warning that this ceasefire is extremely fragile, even this pause, if you want to call it that. And it's easy for a breakdown, especially when you have Iran rattling their sabers because Lebanon, because Hezbollah continues to take attacks on Israel. Israel is now going forward to clean out the terrorists of Lebanon. Because again, remember, the strikes haven't fully stopped and the tensions are even still heightened. And the underlying issues, I would dare say, wasn't this whole point to get a full regime change in Iran, has yet to be resolved, and who knows how it's going to be resolved. So it leaves us in a moment of uncertainty. Reality suggests caution. History has shown that some of the most dangerous periods in global conflict are not the moments of open warfare, but in these moments of in between, in the pauses, these extremely fragile agreements, the times when everyone is watching, waiting, and preparing. So the real question we should be asking tonight is not, do we have a ceasefire? But rather, what happens when this pause ends? Because if the fundamental issues remain unresolved, if the strategic interests remain conflict, this may not be the end of anything. It may be simply the beginning of the next phase. And that is something every American should be paying very close attention to, because it is that next phase, that big question mark, that is the concern of all of us, because we do not wish to see American boots in Iran. We do not want to see a full-on war. But we also want to ensure that we and our allies are safe from terrorism, that the people of Iran be free. We're going to take a quick pause. Return with me after this quick break. Welcome back. Now, if you're watching everything we just discussed and are thinking, this is happening far away. This is geopolitical. This doesn't really affect me day to day. I want to stop you right there. And if anybody who has filled up their gas tank recently knows that what is happening over across the oceans in the Middle East and in Iran is affecting us here. And what is happening in the Middle East is already moving. It is already spreading, and it is already beginning to show up in places that are very familiar. Like I said, the gas station, your grocery store, your monthly bills. And that is where this story shifts from foreign policy to personal reality. Because what we are witnessing right now is the early stage of something economists have seen before. And they have a name for it: war-driven inflation, or what some are calling warflation. And if that sounds dramatic, it's not. Because when conflict disrupts energy, everything else follows. Now let's walk through this slowly, because this is where people often underestimate what's coming. As tensions escalated in that region, and as the Strait of Hormuz became unstable, we saw an immediate reaction in global energy markets. Oil prices surged. Not gradually, not slowly, but they surged sharply and quickly. Brent crude, which is one of the global benchmarks for oil pricing, has climbed close to $100 per barrel, representing a significant spike in a very short period of time. And for any of those of you like myself that are fans of Landman, we all know that $70 to $80 a barrel is usually the sweet spot. But $100 per barrel. And why is this significant? Because oil is not just about gasoline. It is the foundation of the global economy. It affects how goods are transported. It affects how food is produced. It affects how businesses operate. And it affects how countries function. So when oil prices move like this, it doesn't stay isolated. It ripples. And those ripples eventually reach you and me. Now, here's the part that's important to understand. This isn't just about higher prices, though. Trust me, when you go to the gas station and you see that gas has risen over a dollar, actually probably more like $1.30 here in Florida in over just 3 weeks, that's going to cause instability, because that's the bigger concern here. Because the markets don't just react to what is happening. They react to what they think is going to happen next. In other words, the futures. And right now, the market does not believe this situation is stable. That's why, for those of you that watch this, you know, S&P, the Dow on a daily basis, or keeping track of your IRAs or other investments, you're seeing major fluctuations. Right now, it's on a downside. And we saw that very clearly over the past few days. As soon as the ceasefire was announced, markets initially responded with optimism. Stocks rose, oil prices stabilized. There was a sense, however brief, that maybe tensions were easing. But that didn't last. Because as the questions started to emerge about the durability of the ceasefire, as reports came in about continued strikes, as uncertainty grew, markets pulled back again. Oil prices fluctuated, stocks became volatile, and investors began to price in risk, because uncertainty is expensive. And right now, uncertainty is everywhere. Now, let's bring this closer to home, where it affects you and I. When oil prices rise, the most immediate impact is at the gas pump. We all see it. We all feel it. And it doesn't take long. 60 cents within a week when Iran conflict begun. But that's just the beginning. Because behind the scenes, higher energy costs are quietly working their way through the entire system. So think about transportation. Every truck delivering goods, every ship moving cargo, every plane transporting products. All of it depends on fuel. So when fuel costs rise, shipping costs rise. And when shipping costs rise, businesses have two choices. They absorb the cost or they pass it on to you. And more often than not, they pass it on. Now let's talk about food, because this is where it becomes even more significant. Agriculture is heavily dependent on energy. Fertilizer production, farm equipment, transportation, storage, every step of the process is tied to energy costs. So when oil rises, food prices tend to follow, not immediately, but steadily, and often unpredictability. And this is where people start to feel the squeeze, because it's not just as the gas pump, but at the grocery store, and where prices that were already elevated begin to climb again. And let's face it, especially in the grocery stores, especially if you go to Target, Walmart, what have you, when prices are elevated, very rarely do they go down significantly as they have risen. So now layer on top of that the broader economic environment. We are already coming out of a period of inflation. We are already dealing with higher interest rates. Albeit the interest rates, at least for mortgages, are still much lower than they were in the last administration, but we're looking at 6 to 6.5%. Credit card interest rates are astronomical. Some credit cards charging almost one-third, 33%. We're already seeing pressures on consumers, and we're also seeing more and more Americans being dependent on credit cards to get them by. So when you introduce a new external shock, like a major geopolitical conflict affecting energy, you're adding fuel to a system that is already under strain. And this is why this matters, because this is not happening in isolation. It is happening on top of everything else. And now there's another piece to this that doesn't get talked enough, and that is the supply chains. Because we learned during the pandemic just how fragile global supply chains can be. And what we are seeing now has the potential to create similar disruptions. So let's set aside the fact that everybody's like, well, we have so much oil here in the United States, we just need a drill, baby, drill, and everything will be great. Well, sounds wonderful. However, we still have the supply chain. We still import a lot of goods. We also export a lot of goods. All of it is affected. So when key shipping routes become unstable, when insurance costs for transport rise significantly, when delays begin to occur, the entire system slows down. And when the system slows down, costs go up, availability goes down, and unpredictability increases. Now, I want to pause here for a moment and shift the question, because up to this point, we've been talking about what is happening. But the more important question is, what does this mean going forward? And here's the reality. If this conflict remains unresolved, if the Strait of Hormuz continues to be unstable and subject to being taken hostage, if you will, by Iran, we are not looking at a short-term spike. We're looking at a sustained period of economic pressure. And that is where the real impact begins, because then we're going to see warflation or inflation. Because a short-term volatility is one thing. It's short-term, it bumps it up, markets can absorb that and recorrect and get back into chugging along like we've seen. And consumers can adjust. But a sustained pressure that changes behavior, that changes spending, that changes how people live, and it changes how people vote in the midterms, because we still have to think about that. And that is when it becomes something much more bigger than an economic story. It's a societal story, because people begin to make different choices. They cut back. They prioritize differently. They feel uncertainty, not just in markets, but in their own lives. And that is when you start to see the ripple effects beyond economics. Now, let's bring this back to the bigger picture. Because what we are witnessing is not just about oil. It is about the leverage that it brings. The Strait of Hormuz is not just a shipping lane. It is a strategic pressure point. And right now, it is being used as one, which means this conflict is not being fought with military force. It is being fought with economic influence, with control over resources, with the ability to disrupt systems, and it makes it more complex. And that is why when you see other Middle Eastern countries putting forth themselves saying, we will fight to protect what is ours. As everyday people, we have to start questioning what matters most, not what is happening overseas, but what is coming next for you. Because we have to continue to ask and demand that our government and our president, who did campaign on saying he was going to lower gas prices, he was going to lower grocery prices, make things more affordability, how much more will gas cost? How much more will groceries rise? When will there be stability? And this is also a global conflict. This is what are the consequences of global conflict. It is not contained. It does not stay distant. It moves, especially in a globalized economy that we have today. So as we continue to hear about ceasefires and negotiations, we also need to be paying attention to something else, the economic signals. Those signals are telling us a story. A story of instability, a story about pressure, and a story about what may be coming next. And the truth is, we are only at the beginning of this story. And how quick this story is, whether it's a short novel or a saga, remains to be seen. Tune right back in after this. So we spent this entire hour talking about instability. Global instability, economic instability, a world that feels like it's shifting in real time. But now I want to turn inward. Because while all of this is happening externally, there is something else happening internally, inside this country, inside the culture of this country, inside the next generation. and is quiet, less obvious, but in many ways, just as important. Because beneath the surface of everything we've discussed tonight, there are signs that Americans are beginning to ask different questions, not just about economics, but about life itself, about meaning, identity, about purpose. And when you start to look closely, you begin to see patterns emerging. Let's start with something simple, something behavioral, alcohol consumption. Now, this may sound like a major cultural indicator, or not sound like a major cultural indicator, but it is, because behavior reflects values. And right now, younger Americans, particularly Gen Z, are drinking significantly less than previous generations. Not because they can't, the alcohol's there, it's available, but they don't want to. They're choosing clarity, they're choosing mental health, they're choosing control, and that's important. Because for decades, the cultural pattern was escape. Stress? Have a drink. Escape. Pressure? Oh, don't worry about it. Just have a glass of wine and escape. Success? Celebrate and escape. And now we're seeing something different. We're seeing restraint. We're seeing awareness. We're seeing intention. And that tells you something is shifting. But that's just on the surface. Because when you go deeper, you start to see that this isn't just about lifestyle. It's about direction. And one of the clearest signals of that shift is something many people did not expect to see. A renewed interest in structured faith, particularly Catholicism. We are seeing increases in conversions to Catholicism. We are seeing young adults entering the church. We are seeing a generation, one that was expected to move further away from religion, instead moving toward it, and not casually, intentionally, seeking it out, choosing it. And what's even more striking is who is leading that movement? Young people, and very notably, young men. That matters. Because for years, the narrative has been that the younger generations are moving away from structure, away from tradition, away from defined belief systems. And yet, here we are, watching a segment of that generation move toward exactly those things. So the question becomes, why? Why now? Why this shift? And when you listen closely, the answer begins to take shape. Words like structure, discipline, order, clarity. Those are not accidental. Those are responses. Because for the last decade, culturally, we have been in a period of rapid change, a redefinition of identity, a rethinking of roles, a constant questioning of norms. And while that has opened the door to some greater freedoms, it has also created an influx of uncertainty, especially for those trying to figure out who they are and where they fit. And that brings us to something we cannot ignore, because this shift towards structure and meaning is not happening evenly. It is especially pronounced among young men. What we are seeing right now is a growing divide, not just politically, but culturally, between young men and young women in this country. Young men, particularly Gen Z, are increasingly identifying as more conservative. Now, that doesn't always mean political party. It means values. They are gravitating toward ideas centered around responsibility, discipline, identity, purpose. And they are finding those ideas, not necessarily in traditional institutions, but through voices, through platforms, through individuals who are speaking directly to them. People like Charlie Kirk, Jordan Peterson, others in that space who are emphasizing accountability, structure, self-mastery, and also traditional values. Now, whether you agree with those voices or not, that's not the point. The point is they are resonating. They are resonating for for a purpose and a reason, because at the same time, there has been a broader cultural shift over the last decade, one that has emphasized identity, redefined social roles, health, redefined sexual identities, and in many cases, challenging traditional concepts of masculinity or even vilifying the traditional white masculinity. Now, again, that is not about right or wrong. It's about impact. Because for many young men, that shift has created uncertainty, a lack of clarity about what is expected of them, what defines them, what role they are meant to play, and when identity becomes unclear. People search for clarity. They look for structure. They look for direction, especially when starting to embark on their young adulthood. And they look for something that feels solid. And that is exactly what many of these platforms, in some cases, faith traditions are providing. Clarity, definition, expectation, a framework for life, a framework for which to define your morals or your ethos. So what we may be witnessing right now is not just a political shift and not just a social trend. It is a response to something that has been going on for more than a decade, but that has been amplified, especially since COVID 2020. And in this evolution, in this rapidly evolving cultural evolution, there have been a lot of questions unanswered. And young men in particular are navigating that space in real time. And some of the men, they're disengaging. Others are searching. And others are moving toward systems of belief, discipline, and identity that feel more grounded, more certain, more structured. Now, here's where this becomes even more complex. Because at the same time that we are seeing this renewed interest in faith, at the same time that we are seeing this shift toward discipline and structure, we're also seeing institutions struggle. Churches closing, participation declining in traditional settings. So how do these two realities exist at the same time? How can we see a surge, an increase in younger people turning to the church, turning to faith, while also seeing a decline? And while it's, so the answer may be this, the hunger is growing, but the structures are still trying to catch up. Because what people are searching for right now is not just an institution. It's not just a label of, I am Protestant, I am Catholic, I am this. It is meaning. It is seeking out meaning. It is seeking out that purpose, the purpose for life, to evolve one's vision for what impact that they will do while they're on this planet. It's about identity. And that is really, I think, even more so. It's about identity. When at a time that we have been whitewashing identity, that we have been stating that it shouldn't matter, or that identity politics has been so in the forefront, about self-identity, delivering your voice, finding your voice. And these things cannot be defined to buildings. They are internal, personal. They are something people are actively seeking in a world that feels increasingly uncertain. And this is where everything we've discussed tonight connects, because you guys are probably wondering, wow, she went way off the left field on this subject for our last segment. When the world feels unstable, when conflict rises, when the economy fluctuates, when systems feel unpredictable, people respond, not just externally, but internally. They begin to ask deeper questions. What matters? What is real? What can I rely on? Who am I in all of this? And those questions lead somewhere. They lead to change. They lead to shifts in behavior. They lead to shifts in direction. And that is what we are beginning to see. And let's hope that we, the people, continue to move this trajectory so that we can regain our voices, so we can regain what is most important to us, to have security, stability, safety, purpose, meaning. And maybe it is transition. It's not just disruption. It's recalibration. And maybe that's it. Instead of trying to be a disruptor, let's recalibrate. A culture that has spent years expanding, now beginning to reflect, to reassess, to redefine what actually sustains a life and what actually gives it meaning. Because in the end, nations don't change because of policy alone. They change because of we, the people. Because of what people believe, what they value, what they choose. And right now, those choices are shifting. So tonight, we've talked about war, we've talked about economics, and we've talked about power, and we've talked about culture. But when you step back and look at it all together, they are not disconnected stories. It's a reflection of a moment where the world feels certain, where systems feel less stable, less certain, and where people quietly are beginning to ask the deeper questions about leadership, about truth, about identity. I am Alina Gonzalez-Dockery, and this is We the People. Thank you for tuning in for another night. Welcome back. So we've talked about the ceasefire, or the pause, if you will. We've talked about the economic impact and how it is affecting our wallets. And we've talked about what this means for your wallet, your daily life, and the stability of global markets. But now we need to step back and look at something even bigger. Because what is happening right now is not just a conflict. It is not just an economic disruption. It is something much deeper, something more structural. What we are watching in real time is a shift in global power. And the question at the center of that shift is this: what is America's role in the world right now? Because for decades, actually, really for generations, the answer to that question was very clear. The United States led, not just militarily, not just economically, but strategically, through alliances, through coordination, through a system that, whether people agreed with it or not, was relatively predictable. You had NATO, you had Western alignment, you had a structure where in moments of crisis, countries moved together. Maybe not perfectly, but together. And that created a sense of order, a sense of stability, a sense that there was a framework guiding how conflicts would be handled. But what we are seeing right now doesn't look like that system anymore. It looks very much different. It feels different. And if I'm being honest, it is operating much differently, because instead of a unified movement, we are seeing fragmentation. We are seeing countries acting independently. We are seeing decisions being made based on national priorities, not collective strategy. And nowhere is that more visible than what is happening right now with Israel. Because while the United States is negotiating a ceasefire, Israel has continued its military operations in Lebanon. Now, again, to root out Hezbollah, which continues its strike. Even though the ceasefire was announced, there were still air raid sirens being bellowed throughout Tel Aviv for missiles being launched from Iran and from Hezbollah. So yes, Israel is continuing its military operations, strikes inside Lebanon, active engagement, boots on the ground, trying to root out the Hezbollah terrorist regime. And it is independent decision-making. But there's also another play. Look at all of these so-called NATO-aligned countries that are absolutely closing their doors to the use of American using military bases. Military bases, by the way, that the United States built after World War II and was part of the NATO agreement. So now let's be very clear. I am not assigning blame, but it is recognizing reality. And the reality is allies are no longer moving in lockstep. I mean, President Trump has been very clear that we are no longer the security of the world, which we have been in that role since really World War II, even before our active engagement in World War II. The allies in Europe are moving in alignment that serves them, and we are moving in alignment that serves us, and independently when it doesn't. Now, layer onto the growing tension between the U.S. and NATO. President Trump has made his position very well known, and in some ways very crudely. He has openly expressed his frustration with NATO. He has questioned its structure, its funding, its role, because let's face it, United States has been funding NATO at 60% plus. And in moments like this, those tensions don't stay theoretical. It is visible, tangible, real. Because when a global conflict unfolds, that is when alliances are tested. That is when the coordination matters most. And what we are seeing right now is a unified response. Not a unified response. It is a mixed response, a fragmented response, a response that reflects a world where power is distributed and less centralized. What we're seeing is many traditional allies of ours closing their doors to us. Now, Italy, there's full support of what is happening and assisting and coming to say we must take care of the Strait of Hormuz ourselves. We will be in the fight with this. So there is a shift towards more of a nationalist approach, a model where countries prioritize their own interests first. But yet the European Union still is under a very globalist type of antiquated thinking. And them saying, you know, months ago that they don't need the United States for their defense and the United States, you know, maybe they should, break off all alliances with the U.S. That is a falsehood and that they are living under because they have not been living up to, and I'm pointing to you, Spain, of ensuring that your military is at even 2% gross domestic product. And let's face it, even before World War II, before NATO, there was a heavy reliance on the United States providing weapons before we even entered the war. So there is a legitimate debate. Israel, a nation that was protecting its own interest. United States stating that Iran is a significant threat, not only to us here in the U.S., but also because of its global reach through its terrorist organizations. And also the fact that you're looking at some countries saying we don't want to be overextended, or the U.S. shouldn't be overextended. When you step back from leadership, when you reduce the coordination, when you loosen alliances, that is creating space. And in geopolitics, space does not remain empty. It gets filled by other powers, by other influences, and by other systems. And maybe that is what we're witnessing. I know for a fact, speaking to people that have originally been from Syria, people that are formerly Iran, Persians, they see and they are grateful to what is occurring. Of course, nobody really likes the bombastic and the tweets or the truth that sometimes comes out in the verbiage, but they are grateful for what is happening. And maybe we need to take a step back and look at all of the terrorist attacks that we have been having. And again, as some of you will recall, I am absolutely in favor of backing Israel because Israel is our staunchest ally in the Middle East. But also remember, we have created new alliances, new allegiances, and strong and strengthening allegiances with Saudi Arabia and other Middle Eastern countries that are part of the Board of Peace. So while the United States is recalibrating its role and recalibrating its strategic alliances, the other nations are watching and they are adjusting. And in some cases, they are advancing on their own positions or their own people in their own electorate are starting to show up at the polls to make a shift in power. Now, Iran, let's talk about them. Because one of the most interesting and frankly under-discussed realities of this conflict is that if Iran remains standing, despite the strikes, despite the pressure, despite the global attention, Iran, that regime that goes, is so entrenched, embedded by layers and layers and layers, is still operational, still oppressive, still absolutely horrendous to its own people, killing tens of thousands of people that are protesting against this regime. But they're still in control. They're still engaged. They're still controlling one of the most critical choke points in the world. And that is significant. That matters because it raises a very uncomfortable but necessary question. Did this conflict weaken Iran, or did it reveal just how leverage it actually has? Because if you have, you know, some say if you cut off the head of the snake, the rest of it will die. But the problem is that we are dealing with a hydra, a multi-headed mythical beast. Now, I hope that we have weakened this regime. I hope and pray for the people of Iran that they do see this regime be taken out and that democracy and that their old constitution be restored. Leverage is not always about dominance. It is about position, influence, and ability to impact outcomes. And honestly, I don't think that Iran has demonstrated that it can exactly do that. I think it's just that it is a regime that has been in power since 1972 and has entrenched itself so much that just peeling off the layers, it's like an onion. You just got to keep peeling and peeling and peeling until you get to the core. This is not just about one country. This is not just about one conflict. This is about the structure of the global order itself and proceeding forward. For decades, we operated under a relatively stable system, predictable alliances, and honestly, kicking the can down the road. Because let's, you know, everybody kind of throws out that, oh, I'm just a MAGA or what have you, or others, MAGA people say I'm a Democrat. I mean, I love the fact that moderate Republican is never stated. But remember, for decades, I'm talking, oh, President Obama, President Biden, President Clinton, George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, former president, Ronald Reagan, everyone has seen Iran for what it is, that it is a terrorist, oppressive regime that cannot expand, cannot have power. And that is what's happening. And that is what we have to continue to look at through this conflict. And this is why it's so important to the geopolitical world. So is America shaping the future of global leadership? Absolutely. But to what extent and how far? That is really the question that we need to be answering and only can be answered in the future and what happens with this conflict. I am Alina Gonzalez-Dockery. We will be right back after this quick commercial break.